We're ready to proceed with the argument on the second case.
May it please the court, Ms. Karen Lerner will present argument for petitioner for 15 minutes.
May it please the court. In 1988, I had the pleasure of coming before this court to advocate for the claimants of workers' compensation benefits and to ask that the duty of good faith and fair dealing be extended under Arnold to those claimants. This court acceded to that request and handed down the opinion in Aranda versus Insurance Company of North America. In that opinion, and rightfully so, this court noted that in the area of workers' compensation law, claimants were subject to more abuse than any other area of insurance claims in the state of Texas. That statement in Aranda is no less true today and no less important to this court's decision on behalf of Ms. Natividad. It is important to note in considering this that every single aspect of the handling of Ms. Natividad's case, including the check being written on an account by Alexis Inc., were handled by the respondents in this case. Even though the carrier chose to contract away its rights and give these rights to Alexis, they now say we should have no duty commensurate with the rights. They asked this court to draw for you a distinction between a company hired adjuster and an independent adjuster and ask you to change hundreds of years of law relating to duty for the agent for the consequences of their action. Liability for an agent is and has been in this state coexistent with the agent's activity. If I am employed by Exxon and I am driving a gasoline truck on the highways of the state of Texas and I am negligent, I am liable as an agent. The insurance company and the adjusting company in this case ask you to set apart and draw a distinction between insurance adjusters and any other agent in this state. They're asking for preferential treatment in the law and preferential treatment that they are not entitled to. When this court made the statements that it did in Aranda, and when I look back on Mr. Aranda's facts, they are trivial in comparison to the behavior that generated this case by Ms. Natividad. There is evidence before this court that at no time was comp paid on a weekly basis as required by statute. There is evidence before this court that checks were not timely initiated. There is evidence before this court that for reasons unknown to Ms. Natividad or to her attorney, that in the middle of the processing her claim, all payment of workers' compensation check stopped. There is evidence before this court that she was not timely and appropriately reimbursed for her medical expenses, for her travel expenses, that she was not timely able to receive her medical treatment and was forced to live in pain, to travel from Pecos, Texas to El Paso in pain, to recover and to get the benefits that she was entitled to as a matter of statutory law.
Ms. Lerner, the base of your argument is that Alexis, I guess, was managing this account for the carrier, and you're saying that Alexis, as agent, should be responsible for its acts on behalf of the carrier.
Yes, sir. And as a matter of fact,
my question goes to you this way. The good faith and fair dealing goes to the principal. The principal has the duty to deal with this account, good faith and fair dealing. Let's forget a moment that we've got this agent under contract management. Let's just say whoever the employee for the carrier that commits these acts. Are you saying that you believe the law ought to be that the principal has the duty of good faith and fair dealing, that whichever employee for the principal that commits the wrong also has a direct duty of good faith and fair dealing to the claimant here?
You bet. Absolutely. Unequivocally, just like that driver for Exxon driving down the highways of the state of Texas has the same duty to drive his vehicle in a non-negligent manner. If you go back and read the opinion in Aranda and you look at the decision, Travelers versus Savio, upon which this court relied in Aranda to set forth that duty, you will see that it is a negligent standard. And if you buy into the argument of the insurance carrier, then you're saying that I, as an adjuster, am not responsible for my negligent act, even though my company is. That's wrong.
Okay. Now, except that the duty arises because of the relationship of the parties to the arrangement.
And there is no difference between the duty to the parties of arrangement if National Union goes out and hires Alexis or GAB Business Services or any of the other hundreds of independent adjusters in the state. There is still no difference between the relationship that exists between the claimant and the person who handles that case. And, you, and to carve out a special exception sets up an annoyance to insurance adjusters. And what it does is it places companies that have their own adjusters in-house in a position of saying, gee, why should we go hire an employee to adjust a claim if we're liable? Why don't we go hire Alexis or GAB or Crawford & Company or any of the other hundreds of adjusting companies? That way we can get off for our employees' negligence in handling of these claims. And that's the distinction that this insurance company wants you to draw. Yes, it's created by the contract. Yes, there is a special relationship that adheres to the benefit of the claimant, but it's no different no matter who adjusts the claim. The special relationship exists there, and in this case, there is evidence before the court that National Union totally abrogated any responsibility. It didn't even know about Ms. Natividad's claim until it was sued.
Except the carrier here, I mean, I understand the carrier was here. That was settled, but did the carrier take the position that it was not responsible for the actions of its agent to perform the duty the carrier had with the claimant?
I can't answer that position. Question, Your Honor. I became involved in this case after the carrier left. So I have never dealt with the contentions of the carrier as far as their conduct. I can say that from experience in this case and from other cases that National Union, one of the major writers of workers' compensation in this case, has no adjusters, no claims manuals, and every single claim in this state of any kind or nature relating to workers' compensation is handled through independent adjusters. You are leaving wide open multiple abuses to claimants in the state, the same kind of abuses that caused this court to initially say that in the area of workers' compensation was the area where the claimant was most subject to the abuse by the unscrupulous, the unthinking, and the negligent. I think it is also important to note that both the adjusting company and the independent adjusters are individuals engaged in the business of insurance as a matter of statutory law in Texas. Article 2121 clearly imposes statutory duties upon these people, and there is absolutely no reason why those duties, as they relate to their negligent conduct, should not be imposed on them. If you take out the issue of breach of a duty of good faith and fair dealing from the individual adjusters, then you're setting up a very bizarre dichotomy where I can go and I can sue an adjuster for violations of Article 2121 made actionable under the Deceptive Trade Practices Act, but I can't sue them for breach of a duty of good faith and fair dealing, although I can sue the insurance company. This kind of artificial distinction does nothing to stop the abuses that brought about Ms. Natividad's lawsuit in the first place and should not be allowed by this court. To hold an adjuster liable in this case should be done consistent with the ordinary rules of agency and liability for tortious conduct. If they don't adhere to the law, and not cited in my brief because the case had not been handed down, but I think akin to this is the case of TEIA versus Puckett, which is handed down by the Houston First Court of Appeals, and this court has denied writ on that case. But one of the things that the court found in that decision was that the proof of a violation of statute meant that there was no reasonable basis to deny the claim in the first place. Well, in this case, there is before this court absolute continuing proof of violation of the workers' compensation statute on the part of Mr. Steen and Alexis. The checks to Ms. Natividad were not written against National Union Insurance Company. They were written against Alexis, Inc. The specific provisions of the Texas Workers' Compensation Act says that after the 14th day you have been off work, you are to get a check and have a check issued every week thereafter, unless and until the Industrial Accident Board, then now the Workers' Compensation Commission, allows the carrier to pay on some other basis. Express violation of statute. There is no reasonable basis to believe that Steen and Alexis under the Puckett case did not violate the duty of good faith and fair dealing to Ms. Natividad, and to absolve them from liability in this regard is unjust. I think it is also consistent with this court's recent affirmance of the Court of Appeals decision in Henry Miller versus Barnes, where there in a deceptive trade practices case, this court agreed with the Court of Appeals that an agent who misrepresented even innocently facts relating to the claim had liability on the claim. So what we have to deal with in this particular situation is a circumstance where Mr. Steen, by interest interrogatories, by the way, had a pattern of doing this and, in fact, was ultimately terminated by Alexis Inc. Alexis Inc. For failing to see the claimants were properly and timely paid their workers' compensation benefits, seeks to absolve himself for what has now been held essentially per se breach of a duty claim, taking into life this Court of Appeals decision in Puckett versus TEIA. I do not believe that it is consistent with Texas law, fair, just, or equitable to carve out a special independent exception for an adjuster. There is no reason to give them special treatment. There is reason to treat them the same as any other entity involved in the adjusting process, and clearly those reasons are available to this court, but also to the effect of treating Texas residents the same as others, and in those matters pointed out by the amicus in his brief.
May it please the court, Mr. Frederick Wolf will present argument for respondents for 20 minutes.
May it please the court, first I have a cold and I apologize for a certain tendency to croak, but hopefully you'll be able to understand me. Second, a great many of the things that Mrs. Lerner said during her presentation are not in the record, and a great many of them are factually untrue. But given that I have only 20 minutes in which to present this case, I do not want to get bogged down in dealing with that. I would ask that you consult the record to see what is actually in the record in this case. In the trial court, Mrs. Natividad made a great many charges and causes of action against my clients. The trial court granted summary judgment for us on all of them. Mrs. Natividad appealed. The Court of Appeals in El Paso affirmed the majority of the decisions of the trial court but reversed certain of them. By the time we arrived in this court and filed our briefs in August of 1992, the disputes which were left for presentation to this court numbered 4 points of error on our part, 1 point of error on Ms. Natividad's part. I believe that between August of 1992 and today, 3 of our 4 points of error have in effect been resolved by supervening decisions of this court. I will address those very briefly and then try to get on to what I believe is the remaining issue. First, our points of error number 2 and 3 complained of the Court of Appeals reversing the summary judgment in our favor on Ms. Natividad's claim for negligent infliction of emotional distress. This court's decision in Boyle v. Kerr, handed down on December the 2nd of 1992, determined that there is not such a cause of action in Texas, and it appears to me that that resolves the issue on those 2 points of error, and that the trial court should clearly be affirmed and the Court of Appeals reversed on that. Our point of error number 4 dealt with a somewhat confusing situation that it was not clear whether the Court of Appeals had reversed the trial court on the cause of action for violation of Section 46 of the restatement. So we brought forward a point of error so that if it appeared to this court that there had been such a reversal, we would not have left that unchallenged. Similarly to what happened in Boyle v. Kerr, after the briefs had been filed in this case, the court handed down its decision in Diamond Shamrock v. Mendez on October the 7th, which while noting, as did the later Boyle case, that there was not a clear decision as to whether there was such a cause of action in Texas, did determine that if there was such a cause of action, it would be necessary to allege conduct which met the standards set forth in Section 46 of the restatement, determined that the allegations in the petition in the Diamond Shamrock case did not meet that standard, and accordingly determined that there was no maintainable cause of action there. I would submit that exactly the same determination should be made in this case. If you go to Section 46 of the restatement, it gives certain examples of the kind of things which, while aggravating, insulting, annoying, do not rise to the level of outrageousness which it sets as the standard for giving rise to such a cause of action. Example number four, for instance, is a example in which the caller makes a telephone call and when displeased with the other party's response, calls the other party a goddamn woman and threatens to break her neck. The restatement says that is not conduct which is sufficient to give rise to a Section 46 cause of action. Similar, number eight is one in which the actor is a creditor who calls a debtor, calls them a deadbeat, says they will never trust them again, generally is as rude and crude as they can be. And the restatement says that is not not an acceptable basis for a Section 46 claim. Here, if you will note, the allegations are that the Mrs. Natividad was put on hold, that she was spoken to in a hostile manner, that specific compensation checks may have not been received on a timely basis. I would submit that there's nothing whatsoever in the facts alleged in this case, that is the conduct of my client that is alleged in this case, which even comes close to rising to the level which is required under Section 46 of the restatement to set forth the cause of action. So I think on point of error number four as well, under the Diamond Shamrock standard, the trial court's summary judgment in our favor should be affirmed. That brings us to our point of error number one and Mrs. Natividad's point of error number one, which I think is the issue that is really presented for the court in this case and which is of some significance. I think perhaps the best way to state that question is, does the duty of good faith and fair dealing, which this court established in Arnold and imposed in the workers' compensation context in Aranda, give right to a separate cause of action on the part of the claimant against those retained or employed by an insurance company to assist it in handling the claims made against its policies? Our position is that no, it should not. Ms. Natividad's position is that yes, it should impose such a duty on absolutely everyone who has anything whatsoever to do with the claim. The Court of Appeals attempted to come up with a middle ground which hasn't satisfied anyone. They said that Alexis Inc., one of my clients, did have such a duty, and Bill Steen, one of the employees of Alexis Inc., did not have such a duty. It does not appear to me that there is any principal justification for that distinction, and it does not appear to me that it is possible to come up with any principled way in which to cut the chain anywhere between the insurance company and the Inc. It appears to me that the insurance company writes the policy and has the duty. It appears to me that then there are a galaxy of different people, employees, independent adjusters, experts, appraisers, attorneys, accountants, who assist insurance companies on a contractual basis in handling their claims, and that if you extend the duty past the insurance company into that group, there is no way in which you can come up with a principal reason to cut it anywhere along the line. I think you have to either go all the way or not go down the road at all. I would suggest to you that based on the cases and the development in the roughly 4 years, 4 years, 5 years since Aranda, that what they suggest is that the best way in which to effectuate the public policy set forth in Aranda is to cut the chain at the insurance company and then let the insurance company deal with any malfeasance which it may feel that any of its employees or agents may have committed contrary to their instructions in handling the claim.
In that connection, was National Union held accountable for its failure to for its breach of duty of good faith and fair dealing?
Yes, Mrs. Natividad has already received $50,000 from National Union and $27,500 from Revco for the bad faith claims and employment-related claims, plus receiving the settlement in each of her two workers' compensation claims, which is over and above that.
So this would be a unique action where wrongful conduct of a corporation's employees, the corporation's answerable, but not any of the employees.
No, sir, I don't think it is unique. I think as was suggested in the question that Justice Enoch asked during Ms. Lerner's presentation, I don't think there's anything unique about that at all. If I'm driving a truck, I have a duty, such as all of us do, not to run over people with that truck. And that has nothing to do with the fact that I'm employed by General Motors or whoever. It's a duty which is imposed upon all of us by the law. Neither Alexis nor Bill Steen has any obligation whatsoever to paint anything to Ms. Natividad, to talk to her, to have anything to do with her, other than as a result of a contractual obligation that they have undertaken to the insurance carrier. The relationship on which the duty of good faith and fair dealing hinges is with the insurance carrier, and it arises from the contractual relationship between Mrs. Natividad and the insurance carrier. And there are numerous areas in which I may have a dispute with a corporation with which I have some contractual arrangement that does not give me a cause of action against the individual employees of that corporation who may have dealt with me. If, for instance, I buy from a Chevrolet dealership here in town a car which turns out to be a lemon, and I begin to proceed to try to seek redress for having been sold this unacceptable product, I'm not going to have a lawsuit against the salesman who sold me the car. I'm going to have a lawsuit against the agents, you know, the entity with which I have a contractual relationship. So I don't think there's anything the least bit unique about suggesting that in this situation, the insurance company who has the contractual relationship with Ms. Natividad should have the duty and no one else.
Of course, it's not just the contractual duty, because in English versus Fisher, we said there is no generalized duty.
Correct.
In every contract, it's the insurer relationship.
Correct.
And why, if the insurance company chooses to delegate the adjusting of claims to an agent and thereby put them in a superior position vis-a-vis the insured, why shouldn't the duty also of the insurance company also include the adjusting company?
Well, I think for a number of reasons, Your Honor. I think the first reason is that the insurance company, to some extent, cannot and will not delegate the entire duty. If there's a lawsuit over the comp claim, it's going to be a lawsuit against the insurance company. They're going to be the named party. It's never going to be Alexis or whoever else. The second is that once you begin to impose the duty on all of these other players, you create some serious problems with slicing it up into pieces. I mean, you have what amount of liability do you put to the person who put her on hold? What amount do you put to the computer operator who didn't key it right so that the check came 4 days late? Once you get beyond the insurance company, you're going to have all these different people playing different roles, and you end up getting with it. I think if you look at the cases that have been decided since Aranda, there have been a number of efforts to move this both upstream and downstream to people other than the two contracting parties or three contracting parties in the workers' comp situation. And generally speaking, the courts have found it prudent to reject those. Just to do a quick run through, in 1991, the Corpus Christi Court of Appeals in Hartford Casualty v. Walker rejected the attempt to extend it to insurance agents. In 1992, the Texarkana Court in CNA v. Sheffley refused to extend it to doctors who were providing treatment to the claimants. In 1992, the Fort Worth Court in Transportation v. Archer, which this court has granted the writ on but on other grounds, refused to extend it to spouses of the insureds. In 1991, and then in motion for rehearing in 1992, the Fort Worth Court in Watson v. Allstate, which this court is hearing oral argument on, I believe, next week, but again on other grounds, refused to extend it to third parties, even if they happened to also be insured by the same insurance company as the tortfeasor that they were going after. And finally, the Fifth Circuit twice in the Vickers v. Gray case and in the Buey v. St. Paul case, which is not yet reported from 1993, have specifically found that it does not extend to insurance adjusters because they are not a party to the contract. So the two Fifth Circuit cases are directly on point. But, of course, they are simply predicting what you all will do, so it doesn't have any particular controlling effect on you. It can have only persuasive effect.
In answer to Ms. Lerner's concerns about
yes.
an insurance company attempting to avoid its responsibility under good faith and fair dealing by contracting away the management of the account, can a principal contract away an obligation to an agent?
I am aware of absolutely no case law that would support the contention that that could happen. and it is certainly not supported by the record in this case, in which the insurance company was sued and paid $50,000 in order to avoid continuing with the litigation. So I don't think that is a concern, and it certainly is a concern that you all can take care of by simply providing that this is a non-delegable duty. And that the insurance company...
That's what you recommend?
That is what I recommend. Exactly. It appears to me that the most reasonable way to handle this is to have one entity which is responsible. And it seems to me that if you look at the cases over the last couple of years, there are really two concerns which the court has addressed and has disputed fairly vigorously within itself. One is the issue of whether by creating more causes of action you give rise to a danger of multiple claims and of double recovery, which is an issue that Chief Justice Phillips raised in his original Aranda dissent at page 218. The second is the issue that if you are too liberal with creating causes of action, you will essentially trivialize our tort system and will result in causes of action being brought over matters which simply are not significant enough to be the kind of things that the courts want to concern themselves with, which were raised most recently probably in the Boyle opinion. I think both of those issues are clearly presented by this situation in which you have, for instance, you know, a person who apparently answered the phone and, according to Ms. Natividad, put her on hold. And that strikes me as something that is a part of the handling of the claim, but is so minor that you clearly don't want to have a separate adjudication of whether it's appropriate or not. You've got apparently some person that Ms. Natividad talked to that she thought was with us, but it was actually a Revco employee from the affidavits. So, you know, does Revco... Okay, thank you, Your Honor. So, you know, do you have that individual Revco employee be someone that did it? A part of the harm that is alleged to have occurred to Ms. Natividad was that her checks didn't clear quickly enough. Now, the check clearing decision is made by her bank in Pecos, not anybody that's involved at all. But they have some duty to handle it in some fashion.
Assuming that is what you would concede to be egregious conduct by an independent adjuster in another case.
Correct.
You feel the solution to that is to have it be a non-delegable duty by
correct.
The insurance
have the insurance
always hold the insurer responsible for the independent adjuster.
Correct. And then the insurer, as it hires individuals or entities to assist it in handling the claim, can deal with the allocation of that risk in its contracts if it wishes to do so. If the contractual arrangements support that and it is held liable to one of its insureds or one of its claimants as a result of something done by one of its assistants or agents, it can seek redress from them. But it appears to me that the only coherent way in which you can deal with this is to address the handling of a claim, not a part of a claim, not little bitty pieces of it, but a claim. And the only party that can be made responsible for that is the insurance company, because ultimately it's going to come back to them. As an example, if you look at the history of this case, my client handled the two comp claims. They went through the IAB proceeding. They were appealed to district court. The party in district court is National Union, and a lawyer is hired to represent National Union. And they then proceeded with those cases for, I think, in excess of a year before they settled the underlying comp claims. So there's no way you can carve this out and say what you did is the claim for Bilstein or for Alexis Inc. or for the law firm in Midland that represented National Union in handling the claim or for anybody like that. If what you've got is a claim, that's the insurance company's business. And what I think is the way in which to address this so that you'll accomplish the purpose set by Arnold and Aranda, which is to give people that are mistreated in the handling of their insurance claims a redress if that mistreatment is sufficiently significant. The way to do that is to focus it all on the claim as an entity and have that be the insurance company's responsibility and not get into lawsuits or in which you have 14 different parties who handle various slices and pieces of it are 5 different lawsuits, different places. And I assure you that in reality, that's happening. I've got cases in which it's separate lawsuits, the different people that had something to do with it had been sued in different counties in different places. I've got ones in which long lists of them are joined, and that does not seem to me to be a way to address the issue that Arnold and Aranda was trying to address, which is the handling of the overall claim.
I'm unclear why ordinary principles of agent and principal relations shouldn't be applied here as opposed to the pretty rare exception to that, the non-delegable duty. Why wouldn't ordinary principles of principal-agent relations apply?
Well, again, I think they do. I don't think I'm arguing that they shouldn't. I think in the ordinary situation, if I enter into a contractual relationship with someone to do something for me, and if there is a breach of that contract, which gives rise to a cause of action on my behalf, my cause of action is against the entity that I had the contractual relationship with, not its individual employees, not the people that it hires to administer the contract for it. The situation in which there is a direct duty against the agent is the situation in which the agent has violated a duty that is owed to the person that has been injured. But because they were acting on behalf of somebody else at the time, respondeat superior causes their liability for what they did to flow upstream, like the truck driver. He runs over somebody, and he gets sued just like anybody does that runs over somebody, but he's also driving Exxon's truck, so Exxon gets sued. But that's not the situation here. The situation here, you don't start with the violation of a tort duty and then decide who's responsible for it. You start with the creation of a contractual relationship. You then allege a breach of that contract, a failure to pay a claim under the insurance policy, and then you say there is a tort stacked on and above that that we're going to imply into the violation of the contractual duty in order to stress the seriousness of the contracting party complying with its duty in this special relationship. And so it doesn't seem to me that there is anything unusual or strange about things given that this is a relationship that comes from the contractual duty, which just has a tort stuck on for the contracting party's violation of their contract, that there's no reason to take this other person that doesn't have any contractual duty to the person that has been allegedly injured and give them a direct tort liability for the other actor's breach of contract. I mean, after all, Bill Sneed and Alexis didn't have any contract with Ms. Natividad that they breached. If there was a contract that was breached, it was the contract of insurance between National Union and Ms. Natividad.
Counsel, let me leave you back with a question.
No.
Time has expired. Are there any other questions?
Okay. Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, Ms. Karen Lerner will continue argument for petitioner. 9 minutes remain in petitioner's argument.
Let me ask you a question about the possibility of double recovery. If you focus on the claim, as counsel was suggesting, and you make it a non-delegable duty, if you allow this duty, good faith and fair dealing, to exist to anybody who touches the files, then you're creating possibilities for multiple recovery through the same acts.
No, sir, because first of all, I think the Civil Practice and Remedies Code relating to offset and credit are going to apply. Secondly, the really, in a practical sense, the limiting factor is the contingent fee contract, and once you get into a case, sometimes in any kind of a case, in any area of tort law, you sue everyone that you think may be liable. And as discovery proceeds in the case and before you go to trial and when you realize that you cannot meet your burden of proof, then you settle out or non-suit, and the remaining defendants are entitled to take a credit. I don't think you're going to get a double recovery. The reality of the situation is in most of these cases is that until you get your hands on the adjuster's claim file and you evaluate it in light of this court's decision in Viles, you do not know who you have liability against, and if you are looking at a limitations problem, which now, because of Murray versus San Jacinto Agency, we are forced in many instances to file these lawsuits before the underlying claim is resolved to protect the statute of limitations. We cannot get discovery because of this court's decisions relating in the Blackman case. We cannot get the claim file. And so now you wish to impose another burden on the injured claimant, such as Rosa Natividad, by saying they can't go after anyone who has a duty to them who is negligent. It's wrong.
How do you?
Yes, sir.
You cited the Blackman case. Is that Crosby versus Blackman?
That's a corporate
No, sir. We're talking, it's Blackman versus an insurance company. I'm sorry, Your Honor. It is a case where y'all held that the claim file is absolutely privileged until the underlying cause of action has been settled. So we're in a situation where we don't know as we move through the process. We have to file the case because the statute of limitations is going to run. We have to attempt to do discovery, and we have to attempt to analyze who is responsible for this. Now, Mr. Wolf tries to trivialize what happened to Ms. Natividad, and I want to get y'all back just a little bit to the reality of being an injured worker. $189 a week to pay for her house, her clothes, her food, and care for her children. A statute that says that $189 is supposed to be written on a Texas bank once a week, and those checks don't come. Let me tell you, that isn't trivial. That is scary. It is horrifying when you don't think you can feed your children. It brings upon emotional distress. In this case, Ms. Natividad did not get medical treatment either. And all of that was brought about by Steen and Alexis, not National Union.
As a result of that conduct?
Yes, sir.
National Union paid $50,000.
That's not before this court. That was not raised in the summary judgment. It is not before this court. It is not before the court in summary judgment, and it was not before the Court of Appeals. And I might also point out to this court, and I think it's very important to remember that in other areas of non-delegable duty, agents have been held liable. Cases relating to ultra-hazardous activities, such as blasting, this court has held that those non-delegable duties also apply to agents. So I think...
Where does the... go back to the really beginning.
Yes, sir.
Where does the duty come from?
Duty arises out of the special relationship under the Act. And what you have to understand...
Between the insurance company and the insurer or the claimant here...
It arises out of the Act. It arises out of the obligations under the Act. And those obligations, not only by statute, but by board rules, place certain responsibilities on adjusters. We think that also before this court, and I believe it's in the affidavit of Mr. Spurgeon and perhaps in that of Ms. Natividad, but it was very clear in terms of what was going on that Revco was, the employer was interfering in the adjusting of the claim. This is a violation of the rules of the Industrial Accident Board. Here, this adjusting company allowed an employer to interfere in the adjusting of the claim in violation of the rules. Well, clearly under 2121, this would be actionable because it is other misconduct in the business of insurance. Yet, you know, again, they're asking you to create a dichotomy that would carve out adjusters from this common law negligence claim and yet hold them liable under 2121. That is not fair. They grossly misstate the holding in Hartford, and Amicus cites the correct language in this brief.
Are you saying, let me see if I understand, I've asked you about the duty. You're really not saying that the agent, for the duty isn't arising out of essentially Aranda. You're saying Aranda ought to be extended to cover agents who have similar duties and obligations under the comp statute and the board rules dealing with how they handle claims. You're saying that we ought to say good faith and fair dealing also arises because of the agent's responsibilities to adjust the claim under the comp statute.
Judge Enix, Aranda creates a duty arising out of the Workers' Compensation Act. This court stated that a contract was not necessary to create that duty. It is my position that any person responsible for the act of good faith and fair dealing should have that same duty imposed upon them, whether they are an insurance company, an independent adjusting firm, or the individual agent. Now, throughout agency law, the principal has been able to absolve itself from the negligence or grossly negligent act of its agent in the area of express agency, where they have been able to prove that the agent went far beyond the area of agent.
Your rule would include physicians.
No, sir.
Why not?
Because they're not engaged in the business of insurance as a matter of statutory law. 2121 defines the people to whom the duty of good faith and fair dealing should apply. Insurance companies, adjusters, people who sell insurance, all the people within the insurance framework. No, I don't. You know, I personally disagree with what the Sheffield decision, but I think as a matter of statutory law that the legislature has defined the individual who should be subject to the duty of good faith and fair dealing by the people that 2121 defines as being engaged in the business of insurance.
I'm unclear whether you agree or disagree with opposing counsel. This is a non-delegable duty by the insurance company to the independent adjusting company, or whether it ought to be governed by ordinary principles of law pertaining to the principles of agents.
Well, Judge Cronin, in non-delegable duty situations, and there's case law that intimates both directions. There's case law that says that handling the claim is a non-delegable duty. But in other areas of law where there is non-delegable duty, as in ultra-hazardous activities, agents are still held liable for their negligent acts. That is what I think this court should do. And as I said, there is a parameter of people who are involved, and those are the ones defined in Article 2121 as being engaged in the business of insurance. This is essentially a negligence cause of action that is extra contractual. A contract is not necessary. So what we have is a situation where, again, they want us to carve out. I want to also point out to this court that we believe that the defendant failed to present any evidence at the summary judgment aspect on outrageous conduct. We believe that there is a substantial amount of outrageous conduct that is not before this court, nor was it before the trial court, because we do not have an affirmative duty to negate in a summary judgment proceeding that which they do not prove. So if, in fact, consistent with subsequent holdings by this court, we believe at a minimum the plaintiff should have the opportunity to go back to the trial court and replead on issues that have been handled by way of subsequent case law that has been handed down since the Court of Appeals' opinion on this case. Other than that, unless the court has some other questions.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you, Sheriff.
Science will be right.